Like, yeah, that's what I did. I give you that permission.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, sir. You can test it now if you're not sure.
Okay. All right. Let me do that.
Yeah, well, we can see it.
Can you see it clearly?
Yes.
Okay, yes. So it's working. Should I unshare or can I just leave it?
You can unshare.
Okay. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, sir.
Seems to work well.
Good luck for today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Cheers.
Good morning, all. It's 10 o'clock right now, and welcome to everybody, in particular the representatives of IRBA, who will identify themselves by the first person who speaks on their behalf. Welcome also to members, and are there any apologies in Kuala Lumpur?
Yes, Chairperson, I've got apologies from Mr. Njadu, Mr. Kitoit, and Ms. Mamarekhane. They are attending a international tour.
Ah, yes, yeah. But they won't be here tomorrow for the Appropriations Committee in the morning as well, right? Am I right? Then we're having it at 6 p.m.
That's correct, Chairperson. That's correct.
Okay. All right. So over then to IRBA.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of your committee. My name is Fulvio Tonelli. I am the chairperson of the IRBA board. Before I introduce who's doing the presentations with us today, I would just like to thank you and the committee and the honourable members of the committee for affording the RBA the opportunity to update you on the work that the RBA has done over the past short while, and to welcome any of your questions, which we will answer as comprehensively as we can. With me today, Mr. Chairperson, is, as I've introduced myself as Chairperson, my Deputy Chairperson, Nadine Fordun Hoon, is the other representative from the board. She's also on screen. And then from the executive team at the RBA, Mr. Chairperson, we've got Imre Nagy, who is the acting CEO. With him, we've got Rebecca Mutsepe, who's Director of Legal. In addition, we have Gillian Bailey, who is the Director of Investigations. And then to support us is Lorraine from Skalkbeck, who is the Media and Marketing Manager of the RBA. Mr. Chairperson, with your permission, I'm going to hand over to Imre to take us straight into the presentation, and we'll go through it, and various members that are here today of the team will present at different opportunities. So, Mr. Chairperson, if you're comfortable, we'll get on with the presentation. Thank you.
Yes, please do. And Chairperson, it's not for me to intervene and say next. You just coordinate your team so it flows seamlessly. Okay, so I'm not going to interrupt who's speaking when. Okay, good, sir. Over to you. About 45 minutes, will that do you?
Yes.
Good. All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the IRBA chair and honorable members and honorable member Karim. Thank you for the opportunity. We prepared a presentation that we shared yesterday. I just want to share it on screen, please. So please let me know
Yeah, Kulileko, can you facilitate that, please?
Yes.
Yes, chat. Can share, sir.
But you can speak to it because we got this and we browsed through it and some of us read it. Okay, so we should have all read it, so go for it. Yeah, well, there it is anyway.
Can you see it, Chair?
Yes, we can see it, sir.
Yeah, we can certainly see. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. So basically, I'm starting off the presentation to say, just to clarify that what we're presenting here today is the latest information available to the RBA based on its 31st March 2022 financial year that just ended. So we did discuss the previous financial year performance and financial information, which was audited in the previous meeting, chair and committee. So we will not be repeating what we discussed previously, and which is also in the analysis, but we will give you updated information. But it should be noted that we're still in the process of being audited. So the performance information that we're presenting today is still unaudited. I also want to clarify, Chair, that we did receive the analysis from your committee secretary, and we worked through those analyses and the questions that we could pick or lift out of the analysis we built into the feedback for this presentation. So just an overview of content of what we will be covering today. So first of all, I'd like to thank this committee for its support in the processing of our Act amendments, which was probably one of the biggest projects that we ran during the 2022 year. And we would really like to thank this committee for helping to fast track the process. And we will therefore give you feedback also on that, of where we are and where we closed out that project. So Chair, just in an overview, you will see that there's certain sections. So section one, we will give you an update on previous topics raised by this committee. And we also build that in later in the slides to give you an update on those. We will give you then an overview of the 2021-2022 performance information that we recently submitted to National Treasury. Our chairman will then provide the committee with an update on our governance. And we will then also provide an update on the latest amendments and where we are, as mentioned just now, and also an update on our latest registry information, the number of registered auditors, et cetera, give you an update on that and some elements around that. We will also give you an update of where we stand with the mandatory firm rotation, an update on high profile cases, key litigation, and we'll close off the presentation with an update on our Restoring Confidence project, and highlighting some current issues that we are experiencing in executing our mandate. And then we'll open the hand back to you, Chair, for questions. So with that said, I'll dive straight into the update on matters from 18 May 2021 last year. There were questions around and interest shown in high profile cases, so we will deal with that under Section 7. Also, corruption and the Zondo Commission report, which highlights various public sector state capture issues, which is not always in the remit of the private sector auditors, but where they are, there are implications for our auditors of state entities. And we closely monitor the reports, the four reports issued to date. We analyze those, and we've identified currently, there's currently 16 cases against registered auditors that have been opened in terms of the four reports issued to date. Also, we will touch on systemic failures, the gap analysis of the broader financial ecosystem. We identified certain systemic issues that impact at the end of the day on audit quality and the control environment, the lines of defense. So we will be touching on that also later on in the presentation in Section 9. Also, we'll give you an update, like I mentioned, on mandatory firm rotation in Section 6, with now less than 1 year away from the effective date. The committee recalls the rule has allowed 5 years before implementation to allow firms and companies to position themselves towards compliance. And we've also seen quite a number of rotations happening, and we'll give you an update on that. Also, unethical behavior and fraud and corruption also featured, and Jay will give you an update also later in Section 9 around the ethical standards that we adopted and are in the process of enhancing in terms of the definition of a public interest entity and other recent provisions in our International Code of Ethics that is applicable to registered auditors. Also, again, mandatory firm rotation, the market concentration question came up. We will give you feedback on that. Transformation and the lack of transformation in the profession is something that we've recognized, and we'll give you some update and feedback on some of the initiatives that the RBA has embarked on and is currently doing to address the transformation question. A little bit more about that under Section 5. And then lastly, some challenges due to fragmented regulation. Chair, I think at this stage we are still in a situation where the RBA only regulates auditors, about 3,600 of them, and there's the broader ecosystem and of governance and accounting bodies, which is still unregulated, as envisaged in the 2013 World Bank ROSC report. That remains, I believe, a systemic issue. And as the board, we have embarked on a number of additional projects to create awareness and to hopefully address those systemic weaknesses. For example, one of the things that is currently quite of concern is that our local accounting standard setting body, the Financial Reporting Standards Council, it has not been in operation for a number of years. So currently we're sitting in a situation that we're, yes, we have international standards for accountants, but it's not, there's no committee that looks at the bespoke application in a South African environment. That is quite something that is still problematic, and that fits under the standard sector, which is the Department of Trade and Industry and Competition. Okay, with that introduction of matters arising from the previous meeting, I will jump straight into section two of the presentation to give you an overview of our performance for the last financial year. The first area there is auditing and ethics standards, which we develop and maintain in order to remain internationally, to compete internationally as a regulator and a country that has international standards for auditors. We set targets, Chair, in terms of standards and guidance, as well as issuing additional guidance on ethics, specifically with regards to the RBA Code of Ethics, which in South Africa, our Code of Ethics is more onerous to local auditors and compared to the international standards. So we have more provisions in our code. Looking forward, you can see, Chair, we've achieved our objectives for the year, and our activities looking forward for the upcoming year will be focused on restoring confidence through audit standards, projects, and standard setting related activities. For example, we are consulting with our stakeholders on priority projects and the committee work plans are updated accordingly. So we will also continue to support our statutory committees to ensure that we develop and issue high quality international and local standards and ethical standards that addresses our local issues and to restore confidence, but also to ensure that we remain aligned to international developments. The second area is on education and transformation. There are quite a couple of projects. So the first is there's a number of monitoring visits where we have a team that visit the selected audit firms to sort of measure and inspect the transformation initiatives, the numbers, the trainees, etc. At those firms. That's done on a risk-based selection approach. And we've had an annual target of 42 visits, and we've actually managed to visit 46 firms. We can ascribe the slight increase in visits to the fact that some of the visits had to be done remotely during lockdown and COVID periods of risk. So we're very happy to see that outcome. We also issued our monitoring reports through our committee, our education committee, which is a statutory committee in terms of our act. So we've achieved by issuing that report this year, past year. Further on education and transformation, there's a number of projects and initiatives that we've set ourselves, eight initiatives to address transformation in the profession. We've managed to actually produce slightly more than that, so achieve that. And also the number of CPD monitoring reports where we monitor the continuous professional development of our registered auditors in terms of our policies. There were two monitoring reports issued as per the target. Some of the initiatives and activities of the Education and Transformation Department is that we continue to strive towards increasing both the number of candidates registering for our entry-level auditing development program. You could see that as the as people coming into the profession and that are looking to register as auditors in the future. And we're also looking in terms of our initiatives to implement that program successfully to make sure that we get the maximum or optimum number of potential registered auditors through the system. It is also imperative that we continue to improve the quality of that program. So we have an increased focus on transformation of candidates that are on that program, and as part of these initiatives to restore confidence in the profession, we have updated our RA branding. We're in a busy with a quite a big project to make the RA branding more attractive, and we've also updated our CPD monitoring process back in 2020, and we continue to implement that new way of monitoring continuous professional development of our existing auditors to make sure that they remain competent and produce quality audits at all times. That's the education and transformation side. Actually, I'm moving on then to inspections. The inspections follows a risk-based approach whereby through business intelligence, we have a team that identify where the risks are, either at firm level, audit firm level, at audit client or company level, or even if there's systemic risks identified in the ecosystem. For example, if a particular industry is in trouble, we have a risk matrix approach that we follow that then informs who we inspect, when we inspect, and what we inspect. And we're happy to report that we have achieved the targeted number of inspections that was set for the year. These numbers and these reports are coming from our statutory committee called the Inspections Committee, which is an independent committee that the IRBA serves as secretariat to. So this committee has issued these 121 reports to firms. We are currently busy with a business review process, and we're analyzing the technology that we are using internally within the RBA to manage and to perform these inspections. We are currently analyzing our IT workflow and data collection analysis processes. And really, this is to aim to enhance the effective operation and our responsiveness in terms of inspections. And also to move to a more proactive through being enabled through data and data trends and the database, we will be able to actually be more proactive as opposed to doing reactive inspections. So this will also help the risk-based approach, which will help us to optimally allocate the limited capacity that we have in our inspections department to focus on high risk areas during inspections and to give that feedback to the firms and to audit committees in terms of quality management. We are also looking at implementing in the current cycle enhanced stakeholder awareness, and we have targeted socializing of our inspection outcomes and reports. We, for example, issue an annual report, and we focus the messaging to the groups that we believe will have the most impact. For example, we're issuing both an audit quality indicator report that we issue for the benefit of audit committee to help them when they appoint and reappoint auditors of companies, and then our public inspections report we share with the firms and also with audit committees and other regulators, including SAICA, and especially the firm leadership to assist them in their oversight over external auditors, but also to make sure the quality that the firms produce is of a high standard. We've also embarked on a process to do thematic reports or thematic inspections. So what we do here is we will identify a theme and then we'll zoom in and visit a number of firms selected, and we'll issue a separate report on that. So one of the themes that we're currently looking at is how do firms monitor their own success of their own implementation plans, which is something that is required in the standards, as opposed to only waiting for IRBA to come and inspect and tell them what's wrong. Firms must have their own internal quality control processes in place to make sure that they manage quality effectively, that they assess risk and address those risks in their firms, but most importantly, that they identify and address weaknesses in their own quality management system. And so, Chair, with that said, one last comment on inspections is that we are looking at succession planning within the department. We're busy relooking the gradings of our inspectors because we want to ensure that we can recruit experienced staff to perform complex inspections, specifically seeing that we're expecting the new quality management standards called ISQ M1, which has now been adopted in the country by our board, and which is coming into force in December this year. So it is a total overhaul of how firms must manage quality. And we are also setting our inspections up to effectively inspect in terms of the new standards. We are currently experiencing a number of vacancies, especially after you could say the lockdown scenario has been relaxed. We've seen quite a few resignations, but that will probably impact our ability to meet our set targets for the current financial year. But we have robust recruitment strategies and the recruitment drive in place to fill these vacancies as soon as possible. The next area, focus area, is our investigations. Chair, we are very proud to announce that we've, compared to last year, this year we have achieved and actually exceeded our annual target. We are very thankful that we are able to have increased our capacity within the department, which means that we can do more investigations, and we are working steadfastly to open matters and to reduce the backlog that we've experienced in the last number of years. So it is expected that investigations into some of the high profile or public interest matters will be finalized in the upcoming year, in line with the board's strategy to get out of a backlog situation and to deal with investigations more promptly, timely, and in a real time scenario. So in line with our refocused 5-year strategy that was approved in Parliament last year, our investigations department has beefed up their capacity quite significantly, and we'll share a little bit more details later on. And we also continue to participate in relevant international initiatives and networks with structures from other audit regulators to continuously develop and benchmark and implement enhanced mechanisms of investigating and adjudicating alleged auditor improper conduct, in line with global trends. So we want to be seen to benchmark internationally in terms of our own investigations as well. Our disciplinary targets we've also achieved in terms of our detailed disciplinary strategy and plan. So we're happy that we've achieved that as well in the 2020 year. So this strategy, just for some background, this strategy was approved back in 2021, following a benchmark research exercise, and this strategy had 46 deliverables that we plan to implement over a period of 2 years. In this 2022 financial year, we've delivered 26 of the 46 projects, and the remainder of these of the strategy will be implemented in the current financial year. So the purpose of this strategy was to redefine our disciplinary processes, and in particular, to ensure that we implement processes that give effect to our APA amendments. So for example, on the finalization of disciplinary matters, the finalization and the outcomes of disciplinary matters it's a positive indication that in the last 2 years, we've managed to close quite a number of disciplinary matters. And we are actively endeavoring also to restore confidence in the auditing profession by taking appropriate action against registered auditors for improper conduct. We are confident that the outcomes will serve as a deterrent to RAs from neglecting their duties to protect financial interests of investors and the public at large. And they will ultimately improve audit quality. We believe that acting as a deterrent, successful disciplinary action will definitely assist in restoring confidence in both the profession and in the regulator in particular. With regards to the development and implementation of the rest of the strategy, so we have successfully benchmarked our processes against local and other regulators in a bid to ensure that we align to best practice, as mentioned. And to this end, a holistic review of the current processes was undertaken. Our disciplinary process and strategy was, and implementation plan was improved and enhanced to aid in the redesign of our current processes to be more effective. So the full implementation of our strategy is set for this financial year, and this will see the delivery of a number of projects aimed at ensuring that we meet our objectives through our disciplinary processes. There's a little bit more detail on some of the projects and cases later on in the presentation. Okay, the next area, these are more operational targets. The first target there is around clean audits. So we have set ourselves a target to get a clean audit. Okay, I think what is important to note here is that the year that the clean audit becomes evident is only happening later in the following financial year, around August, when the Auditor General issues its report. So the current, the 2022 year, we only received the audit report and the audited outcomes of the 2021 financial year in 2022. And as you are already aware from the previous meeting, that we did not achieve our clean audit status for 2021 because of the material finding was raised on non-compliance with regards to irregular expenditure. Although we received an unqualified opinion on the financial statements, there was that one non-compliance issue. And maybe for the benefit of the committee, this irregular expenditure was extensively addressed at the previous meeting, which related to both 2020 and 2021 financial years. And following an extensive investigation by the board and management, no fraud or loss was identified. So it was found that the money was appropriately spent and the value was received. The reason for that is that this irregular expenditure related mostly to a technical interpretation of single source procurement of expert external investigators and witnesses. And the irregular expenditure was, we did a huge exercise in 2021 to identify potential irregular expenditure, and we self-declared and reported it to National Treasury, this irregular expenditure. And we also disclosed it in the 2021 financial statements, which was audited. And hence, because of that self-disclosure, we received the non-compliance finding in the auditor's report. The board has subsequently, in terms of the irregular expenditure framework, approved the removal of the irregular expenditure, which is allowed in terms of section paragraph 44 of the framework. So the board, after careful consideration of the investigation, the outcome, and any action and remediation, the board has resolved to remove within the disclosure the irregular expenditure. So going forward, we will be applying for deviation from National Treasury on if we have no choice to appoint a particular person with a particular skill set to assist with investigations. And at the same time, we are busy with the process of appointing a panel of external investigators and experts that meet our procurement and procurement and supply chain management requirements. So we already received such deviation approval from Treasury, and we are grateful for that support. And we have, in addition to enhancing all controls relating to this element to avoid another irregular expenditure in the current year, we remain very hopeful this year to regain our clean audit status. And the audit has just commenced, Chair, and we're looking forward and cooperating with the Auditor General, and then we're looking for a positive outcome. Chair, the next one is also, we really very slightly missed our 100% target of paying some of our smaller suppliers within 30 days. That was because of a few number of invoices were not processed within 30 days, unfortunately, but we have subsequently beefed up our controls to timely process those payments. Also, still on the operational effectiveness, so we've achieved another target around SMMEs, and then we have also had one target around our BEE, which is specifically to management. We have unfortunately not achieved that percentage by, the annual target in our plan is 17%, but we've managed to only reach 14.79%, and that is purely because of the current CEO and direct operation vacancies, which is in the process of being filled, and the chairman will provide more detail around progress in that regard in slide 15. Chair, still operational effectiveness we've achieved. We're very happy to report that we have achieved our employment equity plan targets, the overall targets for the RBA in terms of Black. We've achieved 78%. White 21%, and foreign kept at 1%. So we have achieved that. We also have a subset of targets, for example, gender split, as well as disability. I'm also happy to say, Chair, we are sitting around within the IRBA around 60% of our workforce are female, and we are very close around our target for disability. I think we have a target of 2. We are a very small organization with less than 100 people, but our target of 2, I think we have appointed one person with a disability, and we're looking for another person for disability and giving preference to somebody with a disability in our recruitment process. The last target that I'm reporting on is the previous board has set a target to do an employee survey with regards to alignment to the goals and values of the RBA. The board has resolved that for now this indicator was suspended until the next following financial year because of the CEO and director operations vacancies, which we felt is a critical element in setting a culture, and to do a survey now on culture would be premature. So we will be waiting to have those positions permanent for at least 6 months before we conduct such an internal survey. Chair, with that said, I am then closing off the performance feedback and moving on to the governance update. I'm then handing over to our chairman, Mr. Tornelli.
Yeah, thank you, Imra. Chair, I'm conscious of time, so we'll move with a little bit of speed through the remaining slides. So Chair, the previous Minister of Finance appointed 10 board members last year in June. So close to in a month's time, will have been in office for a year. I think we've brought the necessary level of stability to the board, given the sort of recent history that we inherited. One of our board members did step down at the end of March, but that was purely related to the fact that the individual joined a firm of registered auditors, and in terms of the act that governs us, the individual needs to be independent of the profession and therefore needed to step down. I'm comfortable that from what was envisaged in the Act, that we have a group of board members now that have the necessary experience, qualifications, and particularly importantly, the independence from the audit profession. Chair, from a transformation perspective, just to give you some stats, 78% of our board members are from the sort of ACI category. And 67% from a gender perspective of our board are females. Chair, I would say that the board has functioned in through a period of stability since our appointment. Our board subcommittees and search committees are fully constituted and have carried on with their work. Then moving on to the, as alluded by Imre, to the CEO recruitment process, we continue to follow a rigorous headhunting process. Regrettably, we've not yet found an individual suitable enough to make the appointment. It is a critical appointment for us to make. And we're really looking for an individual, besides all the sort of standard requirements you'd expect a CEO to have, but an individual who can bring strategic vision to the future of the profession and us as a regulator. Having said that, Chair, I think that the comment around leadership stability has been demonstrated that despite the fact that there are two acting positions on the executive, each of the executives have delivered on their statutory mandates fully during the period that we have been on board as a board of directors. And there has been virtually no disruption in terms of delivering on the functions of the board, particularly the statutory functions of the board. Having said that, I do recognize that the need to fill the acting vacancies is urgent, and we hope to be able to do that in a short space of time. Chair, I'm going to hand over now to Rebecca Mastepa to deal with some of the remaining slides. Thank you. Rebecca?
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, members. I'm going to take you through our efforts to implement the Auditing Professions Amendment Act. The committee would recall that following the presidential assentment to the APA amendments on the 26th of April 2021, there were a number of provisions in the new Act that were aimed at strengthening the governance as well as the independence and our enforcement powers. Accordingly, the board adopted an 11-point implementation plan to the APAA amendments to ensure that we give effect to our obligations in terms of the Act and to ensure that we comply as an organization. Of the 11 deliverables, we were able to successfully deliver as of today on 10 of those deliverables, which include the promulgation of our regulatory strategy, the amendment of the disciplinary rules, which now includes detailed procedures on search and seizure, on the conduct of search and seizure processes, as well as the referral of non-audit matters to accredited professional bodies, which is currently only SAICA, as well as the POPIA implementation plan, which saw the delivery of around 51 activities in that area. We have also, like the chairperson has indicated, successfully reconstituted our board, as well as our enforcement committee, as well as the disciplinary and investigation committee, to ensure that those committees are independent from the profession, to not have any RAs, as well as to ensure that they have the requisite qualifications to be able to carry out their functions. Chairperson, I did indicate that we've only so far delivered on 10. The only deliverable that is currently outstanding is the board recommendation to the minister in relation to the upper limits of the fines which the minister is supposed to gazette in terms of section 51 as well as 51B of the amendments. Significant progress has been made in that regard, in that research has been, a benchmark research has been conducted, inputs collated from internal stakeholders, including statutory committees, and the document has been reviewed by management and is intended to be tabled before the board committee in the next coming 2 weeks, following which then the recommendations will be submitted to the minister for consideration, and ultimately the minister will be in a position to gazette the upper limit fines. We're hoping that the entire process will be done by October this year. Chair, there hasn't been any significant challenges experienced by the delayed gazetting of the upper limit fines, mainly because these are fines that will only be applicable to improper conduct that is reported, investigated, and referred either to the Enforcement Committee or Disciplinary Committee after the promulgation of the Act. So these are acts of improper conduct that would have been committed after 26 April 2021. So since we are currently still battling with backlog at investigation stage, we are anticipating that these type of matters or improper conduct that occurred after April 2021 will only be dealt with in the next 12 months or 18 months to come. So Chairperson, the current matters that are being dealt with by both the Investigating Committee and Enforcement Committee, as well as the Disciplinary Committee, are those in relation to which the old sanctions are applicable. Therefore, there hasn't been any prejudice to either the parties or the processes due to the delay. Chairperson, also, I think one of the challenges that we experienced as we were implementing the amendments was the interpretation of Section 23, which is a transitional provision relating to the amendments. What we did is we reconstituted the Disciplinary Committee to comply with Section 24A, which simply requires that we introduce a pool of a disciplinary committee as well as a panel of three to hear a disciplinary matter, and of those members, there shouldn't be a registered auditor. Now, in terms of the previous act, there were registered auditors in the disciplinary committee. What the transitional provision currently suggests is that matters which were referred and in respect of which auditors were charged before the 26th of April 2021 must be heard in terms of the old. Now, what this means on literal interpretation of the Act is that the committee that was constituted prior to the amendments should be hearing such matters, which means that committee would have registered auditors, which would be at odds with the amendments and the newly constituted committee. Accordingly, we did engage with the National Treasury in this regard, and following substantive engagements, it was agreed that we would then move for the amendments of the relevant provisions, being Section 23. The National Treasury did, in fact, amend the Act. The Act was again published for public comments, and we have been advised that it is due to go before the relevant committees, parliamentary platforms. We are hopeful that this will be done at least by the end of the second quarter. While this affects matters in respect of which auditors were charged prior to the amendments, it does not affect matters in respect of which auditors were charged after 26 April 2021, in respect of which we can proceed to, we can continue to have hearings, Chairperson. Chairperson, now moving to registry information, you would note that we have experienced a significant decline in the overall number of registered auditors over the past 5 years. While in 2017, we're sitting at 4,171, we're currently sitting at 3,649, which is a decline of around 12% overall in the number of registered auditors. Of course, this can be attributed to a number of reasons, including the availability of work, the risk that is attended to the profession, as well as immigration in relation to all registered auditors. But what we've noted is that the numbers or the percentages in relation to auditors who perform audit work and sign audit opinions, which are auditors registered with assurance status, as well as auditors who are registered with non-assurance status, being auditors that do not perform audit work. The percentages there have been fairly consistent with the auditors exiting the register being mostly those that are performing non-assurance work. So you see in relation to the numbers, there's a decline of around 24% in relation to those that were not signing audits in any event, while the decline in relation to those that are performing assurance work is only sitting at 8%. So we're confident that we still have a significant and an appropriate number of auditors available to do the available audit work. Chairperson, if we can move to the next slide, thank you. In relation to our demographic, both race and gender percentages have remained quite constant or static over the past 5 years, with our RAs being mostly white male. While we have remained a little bit static, we have shown a little bit of improvement in relation to females, which we are now almost reaching a 30% mark. Of course, we are not very happy with the 30% mark or the overall numbers in this regard. And accordingly, we have adopted a number of measures, as the acting CEO indicated earlier on, that there were a number of transformation measures that we adopted in support of our annual performance plan. And this, Chairperson, includes the redesign of the audit brand to make sure that to make sure that the profession is attractive again to our accountants, but also it includes the expansion of the pipeline. And this part of this is bringing in more professional bodies. So currently we only have SAICA as the accredited professional body. So our pipeline comes from SAICA. So we do have the ACCA that is currently in the process of accreditation, with their application having made significant progress. We're hoping that once their accreditation goes through, we will see more movement and in regards to the pipelines and those auditors that are entering the register, Chairperson. Also, we do have the audit development program, and we've recently adopted the audit development program reload, and which has shown some significant changes or significant progress in relation to our numbers. Yeah, you will note that, Chairperson, for the past 24 months, notwithstanding the fact that there was COVID and a whole lot of immigrations around the accountancy profession, we did not have any deregistration in relation to those candidates that were registered as RCAs. In the same light, we have managed to achieve a 95% retention over the past 5 years. While we have experienced a slight decline in the overall number of RCAs over the past 5 years, the past financial year has shown an improvement of around 27%. And Chairperson, if you look at the demographics, both gender as well as race in relation to our audit development program, which is the pipeline, you will note that the numbers are quite better in comparison to our current audit population, which indicates that 53% of the candidates being female, as well as 45% of the candidates being Black. So, Chairperson, we do hope that as the candidates that are registered as RCAs move up and are actually registered as registered auditors, this will see some dilution of the actual RA population numbers, and we'll see some improvement in relation to transformation.
Ms. Motsepe, can I just interrupt? You're speaking at enormous speed, maybe even faster than I, whom people say speaks too fast. And you're giving us a very good input. What is worrying me is your team needs to know you're at slide 20 of 32, and you've exceeded your 45 minutes. But look, it's not the end of the world. We can give you 15 more minutes, but if you can spend time, you know what happens. You know these things too, right? After an hour or so, people's concentration begins to fade, right? Especially the opposition members from the DA and so on. They don't have the concentrated powers that we have as the ANC, which is why we govern this country. So, you know, we have to think of the opposition members and their meekness. They begin to like crumble after an hour. So shall we give you an extra 15 minutes? If you think I'm joking about the opposition members, I'm not. But they can't reply. You know, they can only reply in question time. Okay. I'm being facetious, of course. Right, go ahead, please. But can we round up your question in the next 15 minutes or so? Because many of us, well, I hope all, but many of us have read this, right? But do go ahead. Do go ahead. 15 minutes more from now.
Thank you, JT. I'm going to pause there. I was moving fast in the interest of time, and I do apologize.
No, you're doing very well. Very well indeed.
I'm
clear.
Going to pause.
But don't be intimidated by the chairperson. Go ahead. But, you know, I mean, in the next 15 minutes, please. Thank you. Awesome.
Thanks, Chair. I'll pause here and hand over to the CEO.
Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you, Chair, for providing us a little bit more time. So, Chair, on the mandatory firm rotation, I'm not going to talk about the background of where it's coming from and what it's trying to achieve, but we did an exercise in February where we looked at listed entities in particular, and we found that about, we did a desktop research exercise, and we found that 61% of listed companies have already rotated and will be in compliance with mandatory firm rotation come the effective date of 1 April next year. So we're just a little bit less than a year away from the effective date. It means that there's 39% of companies that will not be in compliance next year, April. So what I've done, Chair, is I've written to all the firms. There's about 10 firms. What's happening to my slide? So we've written to about 10 firms that to make them aware that there's 1 year left and they need to make sure that they get out of the or rotate off those audits. We've also written to the 5 licensed stock exchanges, and Chair, we've received letters back from them confirming from all of them that they are aware and that they are on track in terms of compliance. What is encouraging on MAFR is that we are seeing signs, even though it's still not effective, that there are some of the mid-tier firms that are coming or positioning themselves to take on some bigger audits. And we've also seen some joint audits developing, Chair, to address diversity, which is one of the objectives of mandatory firm rotation in addition to independence. So, Chair, there's no immediate concerns for us now around major non-compliance come 1 April next year. A very high-level overview on high-profile cases. These are some of our key high-profile cases. We have EOH. We anticipate tabling at the investigation at the before the investigations committee in May, so later this month. On the Bosasa, we are tabling the investigation also later this month. On Tongaat, we anticipate finalizing this investigation by the end of this year. As you know, Chair, or the committee members might be aware, there was also a civil arrest of an auditor, which is unprecedented, that we also have to now work with the Commercial Crimes Unit, and we're engaging and cooperating with the Commercial Crimes Unit on that investigation, but we'll probably have to, our investigation will run independently, but we'll probably have to wait for that civil outcome to conclude first. And on Steinhoff, Chair, that investigation is very complex, multi-jurisdictional, and there was also a delay in obtaining some key information. So there's that investigation is still in progress. In addition to that, Chair, a number of other cases, some of them which are moving probably to a disciplinary hearing, and some of them are further advanced in terms of a hearing, which we plan to set down later this year on Eskom, Transnet, and SAA around the SAA CFO. So as well as BBS, which is still in progress in the investigation side. Not always easy to conclude on these matters as soon as one would want to, but these matters are set down for later this year to conclude. Then, Chair, I'm moving a bit faster. Just to say that we are happy to announce, and as you would have seen from the performance, that with the caretaker board's blessing to increase our capacity investigations, we managed to improve the capacity from 4 to 9 investigators, and we've set ourselves a target to get rid of all if all the 9 investigators stay, of course, we set ourselves a target to get rid of the backlog in the next 18 months. We're looking forward to September next year, hopefully to be back on a real-time basis for investigations. Okay, I'm not going to take you through in the interest of time. We're just sharing the investigations and the disciplinary process. It's two distinct processes run by two distinct and separate committees in terms of our act, but the committee is welcome to look at the process that we've set out in the slides there. Chair, Rebecca can, at a very high level, just quickly talk about key litigation and then we'll wrap up the presentation.
Thank you, Imre. Chairperson, the committee would have noted from recent media publications that we do have two main litigation currently ongoing, and one being the review of the mandatory audit firm rotation. Both of these applications were filed by the same professional body or member body, being the Eastern District Members of Chartered Accountant. Chair, we received the decision of the court in relation to MAFR sometime in December last year, where the application to review the mandatory audit firm rotation on the basis that the EBA was not authorized to introduce the rule and or the rule is quite vague and ambiguous, was set aside, was dismissed by the court in favor of the EBA. However, in January 2021, the applicants then filed an application for leave to appeal the decision of the High Court, which application was duly opposed, and the court had dismissed that application again with costs. Subsequent to that, the applicants then petitioned the Supreme Court of Appeal around 22 February 2022 for a direct for a direct appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal. We have since received a directive from the Supreme Court of Appeal referring the matter for oral argument. This will take approximately 3 months, within which the parties have been directed to file certain documentation. So, Chair, that matter is still ongoing and we are still opposing it. But as it stands, it does not affect the implementation date of the MAFR. Unfortunately, the second matter, Chair, is one that actually threatens the EBA's financial stability. Chair, this application was issued both in 2019 as well as 2020, and aimed at reviewing the EBA fees in relation to the fees that we charge to auditors. Unfortunately, sometime this year, we received a judgment of the High Court, which found in favor of the applicants and set aside a number or all significant fees that are charged, are currently charged by the EBA. This includes assurance fees, this includes increases on registration and reinstatement fees, as well as other administrative fees that we had gazetted. Chairperson, following legal advice as well as engagement with our senior counsel, the board took a decision to take the matter on review. On appeal, Chair, for a number of reasons, Chair, having studied the judgment, we were advised that we noted that there was a significant errors made by the judge in relation to some of these fees that were set aside and or the order that the judge had admitted on us. Chairperson, the leave to appeal was duly filed on the 6th of May, and we are now waiting a date of hearing from the registrar of the court, after which we will know whether we can continue with the appeal or if we have to petition the SCA for a direct appeal. But on the side also, the board has indicated and has written to the office, to the National Treasury, to initiate some engagements on what happens if the court does not find in favor of the EBA. Chairperson, we also have another review application that is currently ongoing, and this one relates to the previous auditors of Shemex. This is a current disciplinary hearing matter. However, following a ruling of the disciplinary committee refusing the recusal of some of its members, the auditors then decided to take that particular ruling to the High Court for the purpose of a review. But they don't only seek to review that particular ruling, they seek to set aside the entire disciplinary process as well as the charges. Chairperson, we have opposed to that particular application, and it is anticipated that the matter will be heard around October. Thank you, Chair. I'll pause again here and hand over to Imre.
Thank you, Chair. We will now wrap up this presentation. So, Chair, just to note to the committee that the board in its five-year strategy and annual performance plan have embarked on a restoring confidence project. Without going into the detail, but basically this project has three spheres, which basically deals with reforms in the auditing profession to improve audit quality, but also to address the broader ecosystem. So we have a work stream that looks at what are the gaps in the broader ecosystem through engagement with our broader stakeholders to see what the recommendations we can make in terms of strengthening the entire ecosystem, which again talks to comprehensive regulation, for example. But Chair, we're also looking at our own systems and capacity and funding models, et cetera, internally to make sure that we remain sustainable and that we remain future fit as a regulator. Some of the projects restoring confidence, which is significant, is the new standards that the firms are required to implement by the end of this year. So, Chair, we will be, it's important that we remain ready to inspect and also to regulate in terms of the new quality management standards. We're also engaging with the ACFE, the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, regularly to talk about how fraud examiners can actually be incorporated in the auditing process to make it easier for auditors to spot fraud-related risk factors during the audit process. And we've also, as mentioned earlier, Chair, we're issuing annually an audit quality indicators report with comparative information that will help audit committees engage on audit quality with audit firms. Chair, at a very high level, as envisaged in our Act and in our vision, the RBA must remain an internationally recognized independent audit regulator to ensure that international standards and enforcement of auditors happen in South Africa. So we therefore participate, cooperate and contribute and also influence important international organizations, standard setters, and there's a particular body called the International Forum of Independent Regulators, IFIA, that comprise 54 countries. We are very proud to represent Africa as a board member on that committee. We were re-elected in 2021. I'm also chairing the Audit and Finance Committee of that international body. We were re-elected in April last year. And we're also serving on a number of working groups and chairs. We serve on the African Forum of Independent Regulators as a founding member and deputy chair. Chair, current issues. Rebecca has touched on an issue around our funding model that is not sustainable. Even in our five-year strategy, we highlighted and in our annual performance plan that we submitted to Treasury and Parliament, we highlighted the fact that our current model is no longer sustainable to fund our core mandate and the expansion and growth of the IRBA. With all the failures and everything happening in the risk in the system, there's an expectation that we, as a regulator, we do more. However, for this next financial year, we had to cut our budget by about 50 million. Because the things that we wanted to do to address the current issues in the environment, we just didn't have the funding for that. So this will have a significant impact on our sustainability. Chair, the current way we fund it is we funded 70%, around 70% from the auditing profession, and that is growing every year above CPI. We're getting about 30% of our funding from Treasury, and that is not growing in line with CPI. So it means that we're passing on the differences to our auditors, which over time has become a problem as it now creates perceptions around our independence because we are reliant on the funding that we receive from those that we regulate. So Chair, that's something that it's a current issue that the board has recognized, and we're embarking on seeking an alternative fee model, and we'll be doing some research and come up with recommendations within the next 12 to 18 months, hopefully. Chair, a comprehensive regulation, I'm not going to talk again. I think I've addressed the issues in the broader ecosystem. We desperately need the regulation of accountants in the country to plug the gaps in the broader financial reporting ecosystem and reduce the risk and increase the accountability of accountants. And also the fact that the standards data is not functioning for accounting standards is something that we are engaging with the DTI and SIPC on. Chair, I'm handing then back to our Chairman Fulvio, to Mr. Tonelli on the last item and then to close out this presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Imre. Chair, in the interest of time, the only point I want to make under that last bullet there is really that we are in urgent discussions, ongoing in urgent discussions with National Treasury around matters related to executive remuneration. Clearly, what we are trying to protect is to make sure that we do not lose some of our senior and highly experienced executive staff so that we can continue to deliver on our regulatory functions without disruption. And therefore, there is ongoing engagement with National Treasury on the matter. Chair, that's where I'm going to pause. Thank you very much for hearing us out. Thank you for the extra 15 minutes indulgence, which we appreciate. We're now ready to answer questions from you and your honourable members of the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you to the IRFA officials, over to members. Let me see whose hand is up. I see Dennis is up. Who else is there? I'm sure Zolani will come in a moment. Okay, right. Excuse me. Go ahead, please. Dennis?
Thanks very much, Chairperson. Good morning, everybody. And thanks to IRFA for attending. And for the presentation. Chair, just as an opening comment, I think I'd like to start by saying that the apologies were delivered at the beginning of the meeting. Quite obvious was the absence of an apology from, sorry, I see my connection's unstable, I'm turning my video off. So there was no apology given for the minister or the deputy minister. And, you know, I know Dr.
Dennis, they were not invited. That's not the norm. Why were the minister and deputy minister ordered to be invited to the presentation by a public entity? That's not the norm in this parliament. So I'm not sure who said they were invited.
Chairperson, with respect, I think that, you know, as the National Council of Provinces, we have oversight over the executive. That much was reasserted in the session that we had at the end of January. Following the actions of the minister, where he fired the entire board, and the various issues around the then CEO that led to the fact that we need Mr. Nagy here as acting CEO, and he's doing a fantastic job, so well done on that. But, you know, I do think that there are some political questions that need really all Mr. Nagy. So, yeah, I would have expected somebody at least from Treasury to give us an update.
Yes, Treasury.
The operation.
Dennis, can we just give
you a point of view?
Really, no one invited, and no, you could have written to me or phoned me or WhatsApped me and said, look, I want to invite them, and we would have negotiated around that. So let's say there's no need for an apology, but let me look here on the list. I imagine Treasury is here. In Kulile, who can help me? Who's here from Treasury? No. All right, Dennis. You should put this in a way of a WhatsApp or on our chat group, and we should table this for discussion. But as I know, there is no decision taken by the committee. And Kulile, can you check this in our minutes that we will invite the minister or deputy minister? But if that's the view of the majority, then so be it. We will do that. We can't do it this term, but certainly in the early next term. We can certainly do that if that's the view of the majority. But an official of Treasury is meant to be, as they well know, we raised this with them in 2014, for every public entity falling within their purview, which appears before this committee. And that has been the case. I see Karen Murray is here. Okay, Karen, can you at the end of the meeting respond to any questions directed to you in regard to Mr. Dennis Hyde's matters? So she's here, so that's perfectly normal. So if you want the minister or deputy minister here, fine, request it. Secondly, there are many ways one can hold the minister to account for what's happening in Irma, okay? So you could take a question in Parliament, in the House, or we could write to the minister to explain. That may well have been a decision we took but didn't follow up on, which between the secretary and myself, we take ultimate responsibility for. But in Kulilevko, I'm giving you 24 hours, right, to find out whether any such decision was taken to call the minister or deputy minister, or any practical action was decided on, which is your task to draw the attention of the chairperson. And we will act on that, Dennis. In the meanwhile, can we just focus on the issues, please?
No, to the chair, perhaps we need to do our mandate then as well. But that's fair enough. Thank you. I'll move to the presentation then. So thank you for the presentation. Perhaps Mr. Tonelli, you can tell us how the new board is fitting in and how things have settled down. And I think you've kind of touched on it, but have we introduced the stability that the minister was hoping to obtain? The point that you made about the CEO position, where you are in the process of headhunting, it has been a bit of a revolving door process or situation for the last couple of years with Mr. Gullis and course, Ms. John, and as I say, Mr. Nagy appears to be doing a very good job as CEO. So looking good as from an acting point of view, but obviously that's coming up for nearly a year now, and I think that it probably needs to be stabilized. So good. Just on the presentation itself, there was slide 5. There was a comment about the fragmented regulation and the statement that only auditors are regulated, and there was a little bit of fleshing out of that statement a little bit later. And there was also a reference, Mr. Nagy, to a World Bank report where you detailed that there was actually a recommendation that there be deeper regulation that happened. Can I ask you, sir, if you can just submit the details of that report to our secretariat for onward transmission to members? I would be most interested to read those recommendations and see how we are implementing them, how we're planning on implementing them as a country, and whether there is in fact a plan. Use written questions for that chairperson to get to that detail in the absence of the ministry, or perhaps Ms. Maria can talk to us about whether there is any further move to broaden the regulation of other people in the accounting industry. There was a throwaway comment which I think needs substantial more investigation and discussion about the Financial Reporting Standards Council not being functional. That Financial Reporting Standards Council was established in terms of the Companies Act 2008, and so it's a statutory body. It can't not exist, especially after 14 years after the Act has been implemented. It falls under the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, but I do think that we, and I'd like to hear more, a little bit more about that. What happened to segues me quite nicely into the next issue that I'd like to raise. And I trust, Chair, you're going to give me the extra 15 minutes like you gave to Irma. But it relates to ESG and greenwashing and the reporting issues around this. Now, ESG is the environmental, social and governance aspect of a company, which has become all the rage these days. And I've noted place certain conditions on advances in terms of environmental, social and governance requirements that they're pushing forward. And of course, many entities have been accused of greenwashing. In other words, reportedly being, putting a certain, any kind of standard or is there any move towards looking at how that type of reporting can be audited? It's a fairly new trend, and I'd be most interested to hear how we're doing with that. Right, so the amendments to the Act that have gone out, a little bit of comment on the impact. I suppose a lot of it is too soon to tell, but obviously as the NCOP, that's the main focus of our business, is having oversight over the impact of legislation. And I mean, yeah, so probably just on what the standing committee or the portfolio committee would be interested in. But in terms of those new regulations and the amendments to the Act, etc., if you can tell us, how those have been going on. And I noted from one of the slides as well that you said that you are awaiting further amendments from Parliament. Now, that's quite interesting. We've just done an amendment. Perhaps you can enlighten us what further amendments are now needed so soon after that amendment. So bring us up to speed and perhaps we can hear again from Treasury where those amendments are in terms of the process and how soon we can expect to at length about the impact of the court outcome. I note that you're appealing the various court cases, and which is quite surprising because that judgment, certainly the second judgment, was quite scathing relating to the fees and the way that was carried through. So, I think it's fairly ironic that straight off talking about appealing the court cases, you talking about restoring is not necessarily a thing that you can comment on. But I'd like to know, what is the impact of that court judgment on the financial sustainability of IRBA? Because obviously, if the court is saying the fees that you're asking for are way too high, the increases in fees are unsustainable. So there's the impact of that going to be. I'm assuming that you'll need assistance from Treasury in order to repay some of those things. Has that been quantified as yet? I think the financial impact on the sustainability of Uber is quite deep. Attaching to that irregular expenditure, I'm sure you're used to the opposition parties jumping up and down about irregular expenditure, but, having seen the explanations on that 10.8 million irregular expenditure in 2021, I must be honest, and I have some sympathy for the situation because it relates to procurement and procurement of... Now, you've applied for a deviation, was the one comment, and then you've also said that you've established a panel of experts. And I'm quite interested to know, again, looking at the NCOP's role in terms of exploring the impact of legislation, so it's obviously the PFMA that's causing you to trip up there, and the process is there. But I would have thought that it would have been reasonably simple to set up a panel. And I know that when I was in local government, that was part of the way that we dealt with the need for a panel of people to advise us. And then we chose from the panel depending on the skills required. I would have thought that would have been quite straightforward because I don't believe that the regulatory body for auditors should have irregular expenditure. But, is there a big flaw in the legislation as it sits at the moment that you need to apply for the deviation? Or is it just a case of there are ways to make sure that you comply with the law and it just wasn't done in terms of that? My last question, Chair, relates to the mandatory rotation of auditors. Even though it hasn't yet been legislated. And the fact is that you say that there are only about 10 10 listed entities that are out of compliance. What is the impact of this on competition? Because now, I mean, essentially the fact is an auditing firm, if you're of a certain size, you're now almost guaranteed of business. So you know, what's that doing to the standards of auditing and the levels of compatibility with the businesses that are being audited? Have you seen a downturn as a result of this mandatory rotation, which is what I would have expected? Chair, thank you.
Are you still there? Hello? Is it just me?
I'm here, but I'm done. Chair, right, thank you.
Yeah, look, I don't know if it's just me, because I'm also having problems, but you kept fading coming back in. Were you able to follow what you said? So I don't know if that was a case for others or simply me, but even if it is a case for others, it doesn't mean that we heard most of what you said. All right, Zolani?
Hey, Chairperson, good morning to you and good morning to the members.
Morning to you too, yeah.
Yeah, and also let me welcome the presentation by the board members led by their chairperson. Chairperson, let me start off by confessing that it's for the first time that I hear about this body. I didn't know that it exists. And I wouldn't be surprised that it doesn't have a footprint in the country. Maybe it is just located there and it operates from an ivory tower. And the reason why I'm saying that, Chair, is that the auditing practice in South Africa is linked to the middle class as well as the high class. It's very difficult to access auditors because they are very expensive, very, very much expensive. It's similar to the issue of the lawyers. And I speak here on behalf of the toiling masses of our country who in their own areas, even if they have registered cooperatives or NGOs or NPOs, when they try to access funds, which are grants and so on from the institutions of state, they are expected to have audited statements. And whenever they approach auditors, the auditors are very expensive. They are inaccessible, very expensive. And therefore people cannot really, and that's why I call it a high class issue. And I want to put it to this body that this thing cannot go without being attended to. I think there has to be a degree of balancing the scales in the country with practices like auditing so that all citizens can have access to them, especially if there are treasury regimes that compel people in their own areas to have audited financial statements. Therefore, it stands to reason that auditors must not use a one-size-fits-all when they charge. They should look into assisting the poor. There has to be some kind of a measure that gets taken that when you are auditing a cooperative or an NPO that operates in an area where it's rural, but it also seeks to assist the poorest of the poor, you can't charge them exorbitant fees. You know, in that way, we will get to know about your existence. The reason why we don't know about your existence is that you don't matter to us because we don't matter to you. You are not there for our people when they need you most. And institutions like these, which are established through an act of parliament, must actually find resonance with our communities down there. So you are a new board. And I think in one of your slides, you are talking about transformation. And I think you must talk about transformation in broad terms so that it includes this, what I'm talking about. Because we are only to turn the corner in this country if we have a new approach to issues, which is very robust and which is very revolutionary, which takes the interests of the ordinary South African, you know, into a priority mode. That's the first thing. Then secondly, Chair, it's good that we do have a body that regulates auditors, because auditors, I think, in a market like ours, they get manipulated to favor the capital, so that the capital can get away with murder insofar as brutal exploitation. So if the books are cooked and the auditors are making those books to pass the test, then we're losing a lot of money from the fiscals, money that we will never realize as the poor communities of our country. So you have a huge responsibility to ensure that actually what gets submitted as audited financial statement is looked at through the eye of the needy, to make sure that there is no money that goes under the table. And I believe at the moment, with what we get in the national fiscal of 1.3 million, I think we are being undercut big time, Chairperson. And this structure must therefore look into that question. I believe an economy of ours cannot be collecting a mere 1.3 trillion. We are a huge economy. And I believe we are beaten exactly at a point where papers are submitted and they are cooked. And this culture of cooking, it's long in this country. It predates the new dispensation. And what we have done with structures like this is a cut and paste in terms of what we do. I think we need to have a relook in terms of how we actually look into auditing, so that we get the money that we deserve. And lastly, Chair, I am not sure because I was having an unstable, what you call here, signal. I just want to check. I see that the Zondo Commission report features here and there are follow-ups on those matters. I would have been very keen to hear about the Steinhoff issue, which is a clear example of where auditing is found wanting in this country. Because it is not just an issue that is criminal, but it is directly linked to issues of auditing. And I would love if I could be told as to what has this body done with regards to that matter. Because it's a matter that is being swept aside and as if it doesn't have an impact to us. Chair, you know, the majority of South Africans are consumers. That's their money in one way or the other, if you look at it, directly and indirectly. Steinhoff is an entity that became a huge giant that it became through the sweat and the blood of our people. And therefore, we can't just be told that certain shenanigans happen just like that, and then there is no one who is made to account. It relates to auditing issues. And I think people, colleagues like Honorable Dennis, they must also be very sharp on those matters. We want to hear them. It should not only be us who represent the Revolutionary Front that must be talking about this. Even people who claim to represent a free market must come up and say the gross non-disclosures and dishonesty that is happening in the private sector must be put to scrutiny. And I'm saying, Chair, that I'm excited that I now know that there is a body like this. And I'm here as a member of parliament who comes from the Eastern Cape. And I also happen to be a leader of Contralesa out there. It's so difficult to get auditing statements, even for a board like that, established as it is, because of the expensive nature. So we would be appealing to them and we'll also interact with them even beyond this point, beyond this presentation in this particular committee of parliament. So, Chair, I'm looking forward to these answers because they will be helpful in terms of the expectations of transformation insofar as auditing landscape in South Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Is there anybody else? Nope. Okay. So I'll come in here. And if anybody else wants to speak after me, of course they can do. So the first thing that I don't understand is the Auditing Professions Amendment Act was passed ever so recently. And as I understand it, you as IRBA and National Treasury worked very closely on the bill. And in fact, as I understand it, you had quite a big hand in the processing of the bill. So obviously when we pass bills, it's only in the implementation that you discover gaps. But in this case, because you had such a big hand in shaping the bill as I know it, why were you not able to foresee the practical issues that will arise and the gaps? And maybe Treasury's Karen wants to answer that as well. Couldn't they see it, right? Now, on the MAFR, you know, those of us, well, Dick Lady is in and out of this meeting for practical reasons. And then those of you who are here at the time that we considered it in Parliament, we supported it, but we felt there should be more negotiations between the auditors vigorously opposed to it and IRBA, because we are concerned that these big wigs will take the matter to court and there was huge funds there against IRBA and the state. But what happened happened, and I'm a bit surprised actually. You know, people tell you how often they do, especially it's big capital, that the skies will fall and crash all of us if we do what we plan to do in respect of transformation. And they threaten to take you to court and so on. Well, sometimes they do and sometimes, but it's interesting that the threat, so to speak, in court is not as widespread and as strong as it was threatened to be. So in that regard, I'm making an observation, not a question. Now, you know, I agree with Dennis that what seems to be there on the surface is, and by the way, colleagues, I hope we've seen Poppy Ntaka's excellent, once again, overview, and many of the issues she asked you have responded to. But there might be things, Poppy, that you think haven't been answered. So you can either put it on the chat group since you seem not wanting to speak. If you don't want to speak, just put them in the chat group. But as I see it, they have responded, even if sometimes not adequately, to most of your questions then. But if you or anybody else thinks one or other question or more haven't been answered, put it down, or has been inadequately, I'll put it down in the chat group, or you can raise it yourself, Poppy, or Esther Mohobe can do it also. She's the content advisor. Look, I don't know what to make of this, but you're saying 39% are not yet ready and at risk, as you put it, in effecting MAFR, and you're doing what you can. But just remind me, if it doesn't happen, what are the penalties of forgotten? What are the consequences if you don't implement by the 1st of April next year? Then on the clean audit, as I was saying, I mean, I understand what Dennis is saying. To me, it seems, you know, it's not the end of the world. But as IRBA of all people, obviously you'll agree a clean audit is indispensable to you, like it is to Treasury. I mean, otherwise you lose credibility. And then people who fed up with you also use it to hammer you, even though there's a technical understanding that I think makes sense to me, at least on the surface. Then on the sign-off matter, my comrade has covered me. You know, we as a committee in the last term, for those of you who aren't there, argue that both sign-off and VBS should be investigated. I see it's only by the end of this year that you might get something going, but we can only urge you. Can you tell us, you can't tell us, obviously, what the content of the issues are. We can't ask you any more than we can ask a MP to give us a substance of their case against somebody. But you can tell us a bit about what are some of the handicaps in the way of proceeding more effectively. Then you move from 4 to 9 investigators. How many investigators do you think you need in terms of the new powers given to you by this parliament? I don't understand this. Hey, maybe you explained it, but I didn't catch it. But in the Zondo Commission reports, you said this is not the remit of private sector auditors. Are you saying that with state-owned entities, there are no private sector auditors? Or in the whole of the Zondo Commission, no private, like Busasa, for example, or you're investigating that. Okay, let's jump there. But that is mentioned in the Zondo Commission report. A lot of one of the volumes is actually on the Zondo. So I don't fully understand this sentence, but okay. You talk of systemic issues, you know, impacting audit quality. I don't fully understand that, though I heard you later, but I couldn't follow, right? Then you speak of professional skepticism. What are you referring to there? I think I know, perhaps you can explain. The ShareMax issue has been going on and on and on forever, really. I know in the previous five-year term on the other side, National Assembly side, there was a DA member who knew a lot about this and would challenge you for those of you who attend those meetings. He knew a lot about it, partly because maybe he's a financial services guy, I think, and he used to do some work in this area for clients or maybe constituents. I don't know, but he knew a lot. So I'm just saying the ShareMax thing is dragging on forever. The question Dennis asked, why is the DTIC, Financial Reporting Standards Council, not being implemented, right? The accounting standard is a local standard. Why what's the problem with DTIC coming to the party here? Then on extending this set of regulations, I think our committee last term, and I'm sure the majority, if not all of us in this committee, will agree on that, that it can't just be registered auditors. On the transformation or equity, call it equity, employment equity, you're doing reasonably well, given the sector has been dominated by whites and people of Indian descent. But when you say others as 1%, is that adequately representative of so-called colors? I mean, my own view has been since years now that while Indians are overrepresented in many of these structures, and whites obviously, coloreds are always underrepresented. And there aren't how many, I mean, 1% covers your Indian and colored component. But I mean, coloreds are more than, you know, justified here. Maybe you want to explain that. Why are so-called coloreds not adequately represented in many structures? And in yours, it seems to me, is also the case. Yeah, now your fee model, I mean, you know, I can understand, you know, and now obviously people are challenging on your high fees, as they put it. And you have to cut your budget by quite a whopping 30 million, given your overall budget is not that huge, given the task you have and given what we said, please do your job. Here's the resources. Here's the power now. Sort these people out. Because Solani is absolutely right. The focus is primarily, until Zondo came on the scene, of course, on the public sector corruption, bad as it is. But, you know, even this thing, Mr. Chairperson, I know, that's a point I want to make more generally. Some of the issues that Zolani raises, I agree with, so many of them. But those are not matters that I think, in fairness, you can address. It's us as MPs. It's us as the majority party. It's our government led by the ANC that needs to effect those transformation issues. You can play a role provided there's a legal and regulatory framework for it. So these are issues I think should be raised with the minister and the department. And the question is really to Karen more than to you, Mr. Tonelli, and your team here. So, you know, maybe Karen wants to respond to that. But of course, Karen will reply, those are very political issues that the minister and deputy minister has replied to. So what we could do is engage with them around that, if that's the view of the majority. But we as parliament, nothing stops us from effecting those changes. We'll have huge opposition to it. But, you know, Zolani, it's in your and my hands more than anybody's really in this committee right now, since the others are not here. So, you know, you can respond, Irva, but obviously as a chairperson, I have to rule in terms of the rules. Whatever I think of some of the things Zolani is saying, the norm is that, you know, you're an independent regulatory body. You act within the laws and regulations passed by this ANC-led government and parliament. So you might feel awkward about answering it, but nothing stops you from expressing a personal view. And all three of you might differ, just to hear what you think. On the matter of the fees, I agree with Zulani, but unfortunately we're living in a supply and demand capitalist system. Here again, the nature of market relations in this country can't be determined by Irvine, it's determined by us as the ANC and the majority party. So these are questions that Zulani is putting to us as the ANC rather more than to you and to Treasury. But anyway, there are issues he's right about. I mean, I entirely agree with him. I mean, which rural NGO can afford an auditor? Look at the fees people earn. So do you think there's any role Irba has in that regard? Or do you think that's a matter of primary 100% just for the government and the majority in this parliament to decide on? Yeah, I see there's some improvement on female auditors. They're 29% now. It's still nowhere near, you know, half or even a third. But, you know, again, we can't hold you solely responsible for that. But if you can assist in that regard more than you are doing, that would be great. Now, the CEO, Matt, is taking too long, really. Far too long. I mean, really. I mean, how long has your previous CEO vacated? Just remind me, it's quite a while back. Bernard, you know. And the new CEO, I agree with Dennis. He's doing quite well, actually. And then Mr. Seth is also very impressive. So you've got a good team there, Mr. Tonelli, young also. And you know, it's a good input overall. It's a bit hard to judge some of the figures for what they mean. After all, we are politicians and we don't fully interpret. We've got a wonderful staff there with Poppy and Esther. And Poppy, you write very clearly and nicely. I really like the way you write. You set it up very clearly. Now, Irba has appeared before our committee several times, just in case some people misunderstand, in case the media does. Mr. Mkiva, of course, Mkiva has other responsibilities. He also is the president of Controlesa, and prior to that, he was the Eastern Cape leader of Controlesa, and he has many other roles, so he's not able, plus his children, he's not able to come to all the committee meetings. This is perhaps his first meeting with Irba, but we've had you here in the new term, in the new year, in the new term of parliament, I think thrice. Initially, when we briefed all the members and all the portfolio, all the what entities that fall within this portfolio, and then you've been here recently, and we passed a bill. But obviously, Mr. Nkiva has other responsibilities, and it clashed, and therefore we give him some latitude not to be in committee meetings. But I am a bit disappointed, if I may say so, as somebody who was plugging Irba a lot in the last term and tried desperately to process the Amendment Act before the end of the term. But you will recall, it's NCOP, rightly. Now that I'm on this side, I'm even more empathetic with my brother, Debia. You know, he and the then NCOP chair, just to remind members who are new here, put their foot down, and they rightly said, no, there are too many bills coming from the NA at the inner end of the quarter. The last quarter of the term. But remember also, we got the bill very, very late. Bernard will tell you, I kept harassing Momo. I kept harassing the DG. Bring the bill, bring the bill, bring the bill from late 2018 after harassing them before. But they came too late with the bill and NCOP was right. So it is a bit disappointing that, you know, I'm probably one of the biggest champions because I was around. The others, we can't say biggest champion, others weren't around. But I was quite a champion of this thing. I really, not only me, Tandi Tobias Pokolo, she was even more vigorous about this, right? She was an excellent whip. And she and I were really determined to get this bill done before the end of the term. So it is a bit disappointing that so soon after it, here we go again. You know, and remember, it's the NA committee more than us that shapes the legislation, okay? So you want to lobby them and so on. Bernard, Mr. Nagy, he used to ring me thousands of times, if we put it there. Exaggerations, hyperbole. You know what I'm trying to say? He didn't harass me. And that's the way a lobbyist operates. And I would report back to the committee. There's no like secret deals or anything. In the case you can't do that in the parliamentary process. Well, I wouldn't allow myself to do that. But I'm just saying that he would lobby me, and sometimes I say, yeah, Bernard is a pain, but he's right about something, you know? So, Mr. Nagy, you also have to be like, as acting CEO, more, let's put it this way, and the chair, Mr. Tonelli, you're going to be more like, let's say, proactive, you know, with the NA committee. So I hope you get what you want, because, you know, I think almost everything you wanted, colleagues, if I remember correctly, you got in the bill that we just passed. But there you are. There's a lot of questions. Not all of them have to be answered tit by tat. We'll sit here for hours. You get the broad thrust of what I'm saying. So in my case, I don't want a specific answer to everything. I want a general thrust of a reply. With the others, they might want specific answers, but that's fine. So it's a lot of questions from three members. You know, unfortunately, the others are not here. It's been longer yet. And I hand it over to you. The members who ask questions or others in the committee who feel your questions aren't answered adequately can come back. But I'm cool if you give an overall thrust. I didn't get the drift of where I'm going. Nor can you answer all the questions here. You might want to give us written replies to some of them. And nor can you be expected even a written reply. Some of these things are ongoing issues. But Karen, you have to come in, my friend. Okay, over to you then. Mr. Tonelli, can we start with you?
Thank you very much. I appreciate the questions from the chair and the honorable members. If I might respond to the question that was directly put to me by Mr. Ryder around the board. So Mr. Ryder, we inherited a, you know, a history of a board that was problematic and was dysfunctional, including we had to deal with the, you know, with issues that are well documented in the public domain around the CEO and the departure of the CEO. That created a lot of instability in the organization. So following the appointment by the former Minister of Finance, Minister Mboweni, we used the period to create stability in the team. We thought that that was an important priority to create that stability and to give the necessary support to the executive in terms of just reducing the sort of turbulence that had been created and the uncertainty that went through. So very much the earlier part of our following our appointment, we spent the time just creating you know, stability in the organization and reassuring in individuals that had been through a fairly traumatic period of our support. And in addition to that, there was a fairly significant amount of backlog on issues that we also had to clear and approve and push through. I will say that the board has functioned very well. As indicated, we have had our decisions have mostly, if not all, been unanimous around matters as they've been brought to us. There's robust discussion. But the board is very united in its approach and in the way it functions and works. And therefore, we've created, I think, the right enabling environment for the executive and the staff and the highly capable staff under the executive to work and discharge their statutory responsibilities. And as you hopefully have seen through some of the slides that Imre presented, you can see what we've achieved in the past year. So that has been our focus. As I said also in my comments earlier when I spoke about governance, the CEO position is an absolute critical one, and absolutely at one with the chair's criticism of why we haven't made the appointment. We want to make the right appointment. We don't want to repeat what happened previously. So we've adopted a cautious approach. But as a board, we absolutely at one that we need to fill the appointment. We're going through a robust process, and hopefully we'll soon be in a position to make an appointment which will make, you know, you as a committee proud of what we've achieved. So that's where I will stop in terms of a response, Mr. Ryder. To give you the absolute assurance, this board has worked. It has come together. It understands that we needed to create a period and process of stability and reduce the turbulence that was there before. I think we have done this year a good job or an adequate job to get there and to clear some of the backlog that made clear as part of the process. So, and I think that's why I commend and appreciate the comments that have been made by members around what our acting CEO and the rest of the executive have achieved. They've done in all of that, the background, a new board in place. I think they've done a pretty good job to date. But is there a lot of work to be done? Yes, absolutely. Imre?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair. I've taken quite a few notes and grouped together some of the answers. Chair, I can just echo what the Chair has said. We have a very stable management team. I take myself acting, I'm still part of EXCO, and we are very well committed to the success of and the stability of the RBA, and we're supporting our new board as best as we can. Chair, I just want to maybe ask, do you want to maybe reflect on the impact of the fees judgment, or do you want me to deal with that?
Maybe you can give some of the more detail. I mean, the impact, if we lose the appeal and the need for us to rely on support from Treasury is critical to our future sustainability. There is no doubt about that. We do believe that the judgment from the learned judge is wrong in certain material respects. And that is why we have filed a notice of appeal, because we believe that the process that we followed, how we went about it, was correct, and that's why we've chosen to appeal. But if we lose the appeal and have to comply with the order in terms of the refund that have been set out in the judgment, it will have a very significant impact on our ability to operate. And that's why the support of National Treasury in a very constrained fiscus that the country finds itself is it adds to the challenge that we face. But Imre, maybe you want to add a little bit more detail to that.
Jen, I think you covered the fact that we're taking the judgment on review by appealing it, and we've filed that application to appeal last Friday, and obviously the court order for us to pass credits is suspended until the final outcome is. But just to maybe give Honourable Member Ryder an idea, he asked for the quantification. So if we just make a narrow view of what we need to credit, if you look at the Airbus budget, is between 100 and 150 million per annum. We're really not a big organisation in the greater scheme of things. If we take a very narrow, if we lose the appeal, we'll probably have to refund just over 60 million, which is almost half of our annual budget. So it will have a huge impact if the appeal does not go our way. And obviously, there's further implications, because that refund only pertains to 2019. And the 2020 financial years. So it could have far-reaching implications if there's an extrapolation of the judgment into the latter financial years. But yeah, I think that's all I'd like to maybe add to the chair, to the question of Mr. Ryder. I'm then going to just answer some of the points as quick as I can. So I'll start with Mr. Ryder. So yes, Mr. Ryder, the World Bank report on standards and codes of the accounting and auditing profession, which was issued in 2013, it was adopted by the then Minister of Finance, and it does talk to the importance of the independence of the regulator in terms of its funding. So those recommendations is well known with Treasury. And I can certainly ask Lebo, it's a public report, I can ask Lebo to share with you the 2013 report with your secretary. Yes, if I...
I'm just checking, did you get this?
Sorry, Chair, I didn't...
Sorry, I had to intervene there because There's a matter in my extended family that I had to attend to about my mother. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Chair. I'll continue then. Mr. Ryder, is the FRSC, which falls under DTI, it is a very important body. We feel that in the absence of such a body, it is a risk that there's a self-regulation happening in the country where the interpretation of and so on accounting standards is done by the private sector itself, which is quite a risk. So we are engaging together with SAICA, we are engaging with DTI, and we have a meeting that Lebo actually set up in the near future to bring this concern to the attention of the DG at DTI. Okay, on the Mr. Ryder's rightfully mentioned ESG, a very hot topic among audit regulators and accounting regulators alike globally. So yes, we are very much aware of the developments internationally around an ESG framework. Obviously, there's some developments and you could say some tug of war around who will set the auditing standards and the reporting and the framework and all of that. But what I can say is this is something that is on our standards work plan. And we are already engaging locally and internationally on developments around ESG, because we feel that it does and will play a huge role in future investor decisions in terms of going green and keep safeguarding our resources in the world. So that is an emerging project. The new regulations, Mr. Ryder, yes, we've issued, since the APA was promulgated last year, we had, as Rebecca reported back, the 11 plan implementation plan. So we went out on consultation and gazetted a new set of disciplinary rules, which includes rules around how to conduct search and seizure. Those are all done and it's now implemented. So any transgression after the 26th of April will be prosecuted in terms of the new disciplinary rules and the new act, and also the new fines that will be set by minister will apply. You did mention the further amendment. Yes, unfortunately, that's a legal interpretation issue. So when you start implementing and constituting the committee, you realize that the way the act is written, it can be read that you have to carry two disciplinary committees, one in terms of the old act and one in terms of the new act. I would say it is more of a technical issue, because it just doesn't make sense to have a new committee that's independent, but then you have to constitute an old committee in terms of the old act to deal with all the transgressions. So I think at the advice of Treasury's legal team, they've taken on that approach to rather through the current omnibus make that amendment to the APA. On mandatory firm rotation, I think what is important to note is that the rule is not yet effective. The fact is that we've given 5 years lead time for firms to position themselves and companies to position themselves. So it will only become really effective next year, and we'll obviously conduct a post-implementation exercise to see what the impact of the rule is, including those secondary objectives. It's something that we will have to look at. Whether it has it successfully opened up the market to and addressed market concentration among the big firms, but we still believe the primary objective, we are seeing signs of a primary objective of independence, because where we see a change in auditors, you sometimes get the new auditor proposing restatements and to management, which means that the previous auditor wouldn't have picked up those things. And sometimes those restatements give rise to an investigation into the previous auditor. So we have a couple of those cases that have come through over this implementation period of 5 years. But the real picture of MAFR, although we're seeing positive signs of uptake, I've said it before that the horse has bolted on MAFR in my view, and also based on the feedbacks from the stock exchanges and the firms that nobody is concerned that there won't be compliance come the 1st of April next year. And then that is the whole objective of the exercise that we've done in February, to preempt what the extent of possible non-compliance would be in April next year. What is important for us, we would really want to see the mid-tier firms take up the baton and tender for public and position themselves to be able to do bigger audits and public interest audits. And we are all seeing some signs of that, or some positive signs of that happening.
Sorry, I just wanted to make a point that, just to emphasize what you've just said. I mean, no entity, no company at the moment is in breach of the rule, because it really is, they've got the opportunity to be in compliance by April next year. I just wanted to be clear on that.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And also, joint audit is a very strong mechanism where a big firm can partner with a smaller firm and help that smaller firm build capacity. And also, we're seeing a trend of some of the small medium firms, taking on subsidiaries of listed audits. So it's getting into the market, and I guess we'll continue to do a quarterly and 6 monthly research to track the successful implementation and whether the MAFR is actually making the impact that we envisaged from the outset. I'm then moving to Mr. Mkiva, Mkiva's questions, some very good questions there. So I think the one was it addressed to the chair around the expense, that audits are expensive. I guess the chair mentioned that obviously, as a regulator, we don't really get involved at the moment into the commercial side of the audit product. That is a supply and demand process, as it is a service that should be rendered. I believe that although we'll take that comment and process that comment, it's definitely a unique comment that we will study further and consider further. But I believe when it comes to funding of audits, it's probably because these are audits are required in terms of the Companies Act and the APA, the Auditing Profession Act. It then gets to firms doing voluntary work. It's up to them to decide to charge less and to assist poorer communities. But at the same time, maybe government can look at assistant programs and sponsorships to make it possible for those smaller entities in the rural communities to get high quality audits. But yes, I guess it's also not possible for an auditor to do free audits, because they have to sustain and remain up to date with the latest standards, and all of that costs money. Also, the next item that you mentioned, Mr. Mkiva, was to address the improvement of audit quality. And the importance of that, I fully agree with you that as a country, and no country can afford poor audit quality, which exposes investors or even the poorest of the poor, that is reliant on companies that pay taxes and to be honest in their declarations and tax calculations, etc. So yes, we do see the poorest of the poor of communities as part of the public that benefit from an audit. And yes, that is why the board has embarked on a very specific process around restoring confidence through the improvement of audit quality, so that we have lesser audit failures like the Austinoffs and any audit failures that exposes investors and the public in any way. And that is something that is top on our agenda. And one of the reasons why we've requested the Act to be improved, so that we can bring in stronger accountability, and it gives us more powers to hold those auditors that are in breach to account. Then, Honourable Chair Karim, you've also mentioned some...
In there?
Yes, in Chair.
Sorry, I just want to come in to a very important question that Mr. Makiba Valerie raised around an awareness in rural communities around the RBA. I think the comment I would make, which is it's a very good question, an excellent question, excellent challenge to us, is really the awareness of the accounting profession as an attractive profession in rural communities. And there, I must say that both the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants that we accredit and many of the firms have excellent outreach programs to create and attract people to the profession, because that's the source of getting auditors, registered auditors into our space, because the entry point is obviously tertiary education. So there are many good programs out there to raise the awareness and to make the accounting profession attractive and equal to all. So you might be aware of some of the SAKA programs like Tutuka, which has been pretty successful in bringing in individuals from rural communities into tertiary education to facilitate the opportunity to study, to become members of the profession, and then to stay on as registered auditors. So the awareness of the RBA as regulated, the point you make, Mr. Makiba, is a very valid one. But I'm asserting some indirect awareness, in the sense that attracting people from across the community, particularly rural communities, and making the accounting profession accessible and attractive to them, there's a number of fairly good initiatives around that. Thank you. Thanks, Imran.
Thank you. I forgot to elaborate a little bit on one of Mr. Mkiva's very good questions around the Zondo report, to clarify what are the systemic issues. And I think it's important, the Honourable Chair also made reference to the systemic issues that we mentioned in our presentation. I think what we have to make clear here is the broader ecosystem. Those people that run the day-to-day businesses are primarily responsible for the governance and for the financial reporting of those companies. The auditor often comes in quite late in the process. So you have your management, you have your internal auditors, you have your audit committees and the boards that are there, that are frontline defenses to make sure that corruption, fraud, and maladministration does not occur, or that it is picked up early already in the process. But by the time the auditor comes in, it's pretty much after the business has conducted, the company has conducted business. And the auditor has a secondary role in terms of identification of errors and mistakes in the financial statements, or even to detect fraud. So what is very important is what we sometimes grapple with is the expectation gap in terms of what IRBA is expected to do and what we are actually mandated to do. So, for example, our investigations into improper conduct by a registered auditor only focuses on their non-compliance with the auditing and accounting standards, as well as the ethical code that is applicable to an auditor. So it is often unlikely and difficult and to use, for example, our investigations from a regulatory perspective to criminally prosecute somebody criminally. So I think that it for that the CFOs, a lot of people go to the auditors first, but one should ask who were the people that actually committed the fraud and the corruption in the first place. And that is where the systemic risk is, that if we don't regulate accountants, because the majority of people that are sitting in those positions are people that are accountants and from broader professional bodies that we don't regulate as the IRBA. It's important that the ecosystem is strengthened in that we bring in and bring back into the regulatory umbrella the regulation of accountants, and that is what we call comprehensive regulation. So with those gaps, and I think that is what our strategy is setting out to identify, what are these gaps that needs to be plugged? Or even if we don't have the mandate or the legislative mandate to address those issues, but to start the conversations with the relevant stakeholders in the ecosystem so that we can make recommendations to the powers at B to bring in those additional regulatory controls for the benefit of the country. Honorable Karim, I think I've touched on quite a few points that you've also mentioned briefly on. Just on the mandatory firm rotation, you did ask about the 39%. So at the end of February, we've identified that if we take all the listed companies, the auditors of listed companies, and we pull it forward to the 1st of April next year, there will be 39%, and it's just over 100 listed entities that would be in breach of the mandatory firm rotation rule. However, that seemed like quite a high percentage, and that's why we wrote to the CEOs of the largest 10 firms, as well as the stock exchanges. And I must say, from the feedback that we received from them, was that they are aware, they know there's a little under a year left, but rest assured they are aware and they are positioning themselves with their clients to rotate and not be in breach. You did ask what would happen if somebody is found guilty or found to be in breach. So at that point in time, all I can say is that it will probably result in a referral for investigation because it is a fundamental failure in terms of the rule, and that the types of sanctions, etc., will be imposed because the transgression would be after the new act was promulgated. The investigation and the investigation, etc., in terms of the new disciplinary rules and the new fines would apply to those auditors that are found to be in breach. Jay, you mentioned, you asked on Steinhoff and VBS that we can't share really a lot of information around the what's happening with those investigations, other than to say that it is in progress. You did ask about some of the handicaps around that. And yeah, I think all I can say at this point is that these processes are legal processes that you have two legal opposing legal teams that are involved in this process. So there's that stalls the process, especially if a registered auditor doesn't accept the sanction, then it needs to go through a disciplinary hearing. That also prolongs the process. And another thing is, for example, in Steinhoff, it's an extremely complex setup, how that structure operates. It goes across a number of jurisdictions, including Europe. And yes, to collaborate and share information across jurisdictions is quite challenging and does take time to get the information. But all we can say is that we have more resources available to us now, and we are hard at work at bringing those investigations to a close as speedily as possible. So you asked whether the 9 investigators are enough. So Chair, when we did an exercise with our director, Gillian, on the investigations, she did a very detailed exercise around how, if we take the 9 investigators that we have plus the external investigators that we have on board, we envisage that we would wipe out the backlog investigations within 18 months. The risks, we also need to be responsible to not overcapacitate the unit, so that when we get to back to a real-time basis, that we don't sit with too much capacity and then we have to lay off people. So we are cautiously, responsibly growing the team as it is needed. We believe for now the 9 should suffice in getting the backlog sorted out. But we're constantly revisiting and see how how it plays out. But we're really grateful for the support of Treasury in terms of budget and support of the previous board, the current board, in growing and increasing the capacity of our investigations unit. We're also busy restructuring the unit so that there's more layers and reporting lines to be more effective in bringing cases to a close quicker. Chair, to answer your question around the Zondo, I went back to that paragraph that you mentioned, and I admit that that could be a bit confusing. It's obviously public knowledge that the Zondo report doesn't only look at public companies and state-owned companies and state-owned auditors. It implicates the broad system of the accounting and the auditing profession. So yes, Chair, you are right that perhaps that sentence isn't clear. What we're trying to say there is that some of the cases involve where it involves private sector auditors, we are tracking and lifting those out of the Zondo reports. We have even cooperated with Zondo to provide them with information on some of the topics. So we're collaborating, and we are where we deem it necessary to investigate a registered auditor because of the outcomes of the Zondo report, we will do so. And that is why we said that we already have 16 open cases emanating from the Zondo reports, that we will investigate those auditors that are implicated. So I'm almost done on the Sharemax matter. Yes, this case has gone on for quite a number of years. I must say, when I just started out as acting CEO, I had to sign court papers for Sharemax, because basically what happened is our disciplinary process was halted because the auditors of Sharemax took us to court. They demanded that some of our DC members were not objective, etc. And this is all public knowledge, and they requested that these members recuse themselves. And obviously, we are the disciplinary committee is opposing that view, and that is why we are sitting with a court a process now, as opposed to a disciplinary process. And what we're really hopeful for is that the court process can conclude, and then we can reignite the disciplinary process and actually bring the case and the auditors to respond to the charges as part of the disciplinary process. So Chair, yes, that is the one that you mentioned. Then just some clarity on the other. So Chair, the three elements that we put in our performance information aren't all the measures in terms of our employment equity plan. We in fact, the 1% talks to foreigners. So we have a 1% target not to exceed the appointment of foreign nationals. So the 1% does not talk to other races. In fact, the white, black, and the foreign nationals are some of the extremes, but to simplify the performance objectives. But we have a very detailed employment equity plan that we submit to the Department of Labor annually. And I can say, for example, under colored males, we are actually at 4%. Our target is 2%. And on colored females, our target is 8%, but we're actually standing at 9%. So the performance objectives just picked out the extreme elements of our employment equity targets. But I can say that our employment equity targets look very well across the board, across all races and across gender, and as well as disability. I think you did again mention the 30%. We're approaching, crawling basically to increase gender female representativity in our RA database. But I think what Rebecca has said is that we are hopeful in terms of the pipeline. If we look at all the new entrants that are looking to become RAs, we see a much better picture there, 45% female, And we are hoping that over time that we can, through our mechanisms and our transformation initiative, that we can retain females in the profession, so that we can eventually grow that not just the gender, but also the race demographics of our registered auditors. Chair, I think our chair has responded to the CEO, and we take your point, Chair, to be more proactive, not to be scared to approach you. We appreciate the comment, and we'll certainly take that back and consider that for future engagement on complex issues that the IRBA is dealing with. Chair, I'm not sure. I think I've covered most of the points. I would then just maybe there were some points I think for National Treasury, but at this point maybe I'll just hear from my chairman if there's anything that he would like to add.
Yeah, so Imre, I think we had a question from the chair and also Honourable Ryder around the irregular expenditure. Perhaps just give a bit more granularity as to what gave rise to that in the particular circumstances. So there's perhaps just a better understanding of that point and the fact that I think we've already explained how we've dealt with that going forward. But I think it might just be useful for the benefit of the members and the chair who both raised a similar question, just to that we just provide a little bit of granularity on that point. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm not going to address the process that the board took to investigate and to clear the matter in terms of the framework. But what is important is what gave rise to the 10 odd million irregular expenditure is the Auditor General in 2019 flagged a couple of payments or procurement of single source experts. They questioned whether we followed a due process. We've been following a single source process for expert external investigators since as far back as 2012. There was a technical memo that Treasury issued, I'm talking under correction, Chair, but it could have been around 2016 or 2017. What transpired is that obviously that technical memo has not the way it was interpreted did not change the way the IRBA procured single source expert investigators. What makes it difficult for the IRBA is firstly, you can't use anybody from an audit firm to investigate another audit firm because we need to remain independent. And also that makes that pool of people that are out there to a handful of people on, let's say, for example, the expert that we used on the African bank matter was appointed as a single source at the time. That was necessary to bring the African bank matter to a close, and we all know that was a successful investigation. But yes, it boiled down eventually in 2019 when the AG raised the interpretation of a technical memo that when you used when you want to use single source, it is no longer deemed appropriate. You either have to apply to National Treasury for deviation. And we've subsequently done that, and Treasury has approved some deviation where we could demonstrate that this is a very scarce, unique set of skills that we need to prosecute on a particular technical matter. But Chair, what they also said is what would be more appropriate is to have a panel of expert investigators and witnesses that we follow a tender process, and then there's a panel that you set up. And then you can appoint through rotation from that panel. So that is exactly what we've embarked on. That process is currently going on in terms of establishing a panel, and we've stopped appointing anybody in terms of single source. So Chair, that's really at the essence, at the heart of this is really the limited pool that forced us to look at a limited pool of people. And up to a certain point, it was like the Auditor General did not raise this as an issue prior to 2019, 2020, which means that there was a term where everybody interpreted it to be appropriate. So, as the IRBA, taking our responsibility as a regulator serious, we recognize that when we have to also set the example that if something goes wrong, we take responsibility and we act responsibly in the public interest. So we self-investigated then, going back to 2012, how many of these appointments did we make in terms of a single source. It's not a lot of them, but we went back and that's where we came up with the 10+ million procurement going back to 2012. So if you look at the disclosure in the financials, you'll see that it was disclosed the in terms of the previous financial years as well. That is exactly what happened, and we were at all times responsible, transparent. We reported to National Treasury, the board, and we disclosed it in our financial statements. So there's no secret in terms of what it is about and how we're planning to address the issue going forward. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, look, I think you've covered a lot. You've been quite comprehensive. Unless members have some other dissatisfaction can come in, but I would like to hear Karen. I'm sure we all want to. Karen, several of the questions are directed to you or your political principles. Can you come in, please?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, and also the members, and good afternoon to all of you. As Minister's representative on the IRBA board, I'm pleased to report that we've got a very credible board at this stage. The chairman has not been lying to you. I think we took quite a while as Treasury to get the correct mix. We had some very definite requirements of the Act to fulfill in terms of professionals. So we took our time on that, and I think it's paid off. We now got a very credible board. There's a lot of experienced individuals there. And I think the most important thing is that they work well as a collective. The subcommittees are working well. And I can also report that most of the backlog has been cleared by this board. So all the documents and standards issues have been dealt with. It's also been quite a challenging time in terms of the court cases that I think Rebecca has been reported on. And I think the board has been proactive. Minister is always aware and on top of the issues, so the information is flowing to National Treasury on that. So I think there's a good relationship between us. Of course, there's a lot more work to do, and I think the board's plan also includes a number of meetings with Minister on the future and those collective processes that we also outlined here today. As you mentioned, Chair, I would rather not comment now on the political issues, but I've already started a list that I can take up with TM and Minister on those issues. And I promise to also meet with our legal representative just on the new bill, and then not to bring unnecessarily burden to Parliament on those issues. And then we all know it's a lot of work to bring new amendments to the committees. I think a very good progress so far by this board, and we look forward. And I have been part of the process as well to appoint the new CEO. We know how urgent it is, but we also take into consideration that we need the right person for this role. Thank you, Chair.
Do you want to say anything about the suggestion that either you or IRBA should have picked up the practical problem that's arisen in the legislation?
I'll get back to my legal team. I'll just mention it to MP. I know she's been working closely with Rebecca and the team on this. I know that bill we took, as you mentioned, it was quite a process to get it through, and the timing was. But I do think there were some other amendments as well that we said we're not going to address in the previous round. So I think it will serve a purpose if we bring a new holistic, but I'll take it up with MP and our legal team.
Okay, but just note that I don't think we think it's a burden to propose this legislation. That's our job. It's just that we would prefer the quality of legislation that comes to us to be maybe overall better. Now, at this stage, you're talking about an omnibus piece of legislation. Is that going through the cabinet process, or where is it? Excuse me. Has it already been tabled in Parliament on the NA side, or is it still in the cabinet pipeline?
As far as I'm aware, it's still with our minister here, so it hasn't reached cabinet yet, but Rebecca can perhaps confirm, but that's how far I'm aware.
Rebecca, do you have anything to say? Do you know where the progress is?
Yes, Chair, when we followed up last week with National Treasury, we were advised that the bill is finalized and that they were hoping to submit it to the office of the Chief State Legal Advisor for certification in the previous week.
All right, okay, we'll leave it there. The colleagues, have any other questions? Dennis, yes?
Yeah, Chair, thanks very much. Sorry, and I note that my Kosher Park connection is still quite unstable, but yeah, so appreciation for all of the answers. Thank you very much. The one I just want to scratch a little bit deeper relates to the Financial Reporting Standards Council. Just to get a proper picture, has that entity been functioning? Why did it stop functioning? Or if it was, if it hasn't been functioning ever, you know, I think we've got a long gap, and that's not what my experience is in terms of seeing updates to standard practices. So just a little bit more on that Financial Reporting Standards Council. It's something that I really think that we need to pick up on. Thanks, Chair.
Karen, you might also want to come in on this, but let's have Irba first.
So I'll respond to that. Yes, Mr. Ryder, the Financial Reporting Standards Council obviously falls under DTIC. We have no jurisdiction over accounting standard setting in the country, and that is why we've identified that particular body not functioning as a risk in the broader ecosystem. As you can imagine, if there's guidance needed on a particular interpretation of an accounting standard, if there's no regulatory body that puts out those guidance, it's been left up for interpretation by professionals without that level of oversight. So it is a concern to us. Obviously, I'm not in a position to answer the question as to why this body is not functioning. All that I know is it hasn't been functioning for years. It hasn't been functioning for probably more than 2 years, could be even longer. I think with that prolonged time, I've engaged with SAICA CEO to say let's write a letter together to the minister to just highlight the risks and that we see in not having this body functioning, and to engage with the department around our concerns. And that is something that is in our pipeline in terms of our stakeholder engagement with DTIC in the coming month or two. Should we be able to secure a meeting with them? So yes, Mr. Ryder, I'm afraid I don't have the reasons why the committee was seized. That unfortunately I don't have that information readily available.
Aaron, can't you do something as Treasury to put some pressure on your fellow department?
Thank you, Chair. We also had some suggestions on how we could get this working. It was probably also 2 or 3 years ago, but there was no action. But I think it's upon us to take that up again and stress the importance. We've got a new minister that is keen to get things working again. So I'm pretty sure that we
Good.
Can take it up.
Okay. Again. So listen, Esther and Nkululeko, can you write a list of things that they have agreed to do as Treasury and or IRBA and outstanding issues? And so we meet next, we're not going to cover simply yet another quarter. We want to know what progress there's been, okay? So currently, we're sort of alerting you that we want answers to the questions that are outstanding today and progress on what's happened between today and the next time we meet you. Okay, so unless there's anything else, I think we should draw the meeting to a close. It's been a very fruitful meeting. Overall encouraging, if I may say so. Not if I may say so, I do say so, and I hope the majority agree. And I thank you all from IRBA for the very interesting inputs you've made and to the colleagues for participating. Okay, thank you indeed. We bring the meeting to a close.
Thank you, Chair.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Long live the chair.